Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Shankleberg. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, good to hear you again. And we were chatting before we got on it, and it sounds like you're getting ready to go to the Bahamas to hang out with your Bermuda shorts and all that good stuff. Can you wear Bermuda shorts in the Bahamas, or is that somewhere else you're supposed to do that?
See, Leo, you good? No, you only wear Bahama shorts in the Bahamas.
Okay. Yeah. So have a good trip. Hope that all goes well.
I'm but looking before forward
you,
to it.
Before you head off, I got this note in LinkedIn, and I knew it was right up your alley, so we had to talk about it. And this guy said there's a shindig, in quotes, he put it, in Finland, and it's where he was part of the design team for the Nokia 9210 communicator, and 25-year anniversary was the shindig coming up. And he said
is a product.
Yeah, right. This is a little phone-type system. I think it's before flip phones even. We were talking about that a little bit.
Yeah.
A 25-year-old, and he says, I keep a lot of my old stuff like that, old stuff I worked on, especially. I keep copies of those laying around. So I dug it out, plugged it in, and it took 80% of its charge, and it fired right up. He said, it doesn't have all the bells and whistles and features of stuff today, but it works.
Right.
And he said, the quote that I thought was great was, he said, I know we seriously over-engineered that. And he said, in part because there is no point of reference internally for that product class. We'd never made it before. So anything that was unsure, we made it more robust, is kind of the gist I got out of it. But it also reminded me, I wrote back to him, to Stefan, and I said, you got to see Kirk's article, the drain in the bathtub curve.
Exactly.
Kind of that.
Right. Right. It sums it up, is that technological obsolescence comes well before electronic components use up their intrinsic life. And I mean, mechanical components are a little different. Especially if they consume material off each other, like gears and motors and
friction. Are motors, there's industrial motors that have been running for 50 years.
Exactly.
If they're designed well and maintained well and greased and stuff properly, they will last a long, long, long time.
Well, let's see. This I have a radon gas mitigation system was installed in my house, and I don't know when. We've been here, we bought it 10 years ago, and the house was built in 83. I imagine in one of the sales between the 80s and 90s, there was a radon test and they found some. So basically, that's basically pumping out from around the basement part and around the ground, I guess, a fan that constantly runs next to my, and it has an exhaust on the outside next to my fireplace, on the outside of the house. And
does that make the fire burn brighter or something?
No, it's not anything to do with it, because it's down in my basement that it sucks it out. But that thing has been running continuously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for certainly over 10 years. And I go, when is that going to fail? I mean, is it going to fail?
No, it probably doesn't. I mean, you've had power outages, so it's had to restart, right?
Right, yeah.
So I know I've told the story, maybe not to you, but I was at Hewlett Packard, one of my colleagues was looking at spares, what suppliers are being used the most often in spares. And usually it was a one-to-one replacement. So if we bought XYZ company fan, it was replaced with an XYZ company fan. There was a replacement part. So because of the design specs and requirements and stuff. And he was like, he was looking for bad actors or for bad designs. But what stood out of all the data was this one company was head and shoulders more reliable than anything else. He says, we bought 10 spares 10 years ago and we haven't used any yet. It was kind of that markedly different than anything else.
Right.
And so I went down and talked to him and says, how do you do this? And he goes, do what? And he goes, how do you design such reliable products? Well, we test them. And he, this general manager had no idea how to answer my question. He had really no idea what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And so he showed me this, along one of the hallways, they had this glass enclosed room with all these little shelves on it and all of the different fans they made, different model and families of fans, little itty bitty, you know, half inch square ones that sit on top of a component to, you know, ones that feed the whole server and all, and even bigger ones, some that were 12 inches on the side. And they all had little streamers on them and they were all blown away and you could see everything was running. And he says, how does that help you know it's reliable? He goes, well, they've been running forever, but there's no back pressure. There's no cycling. There's no dust. And I said, what's that great big box over there in the corner? It looks like an uninterrupted power supply. He goes, oh, yeah, we put that in there because it was cheaper than having our tech go in there and get them all spinning again after a power outage.
No.
It's like, you know, none of those have bearings in them anymore.
I know. Well, I did, to be fair, I did replace my recently the exhaust fan in my wife's bathroom. And I suspect because what I had to do, I mean, looking at the dust and everything, that it might have been installed when this house was built in 1983. So, you know, how many, 30 years?
Yeah.
Or more, you know, and it was just, it just had bearings slowed it down. So it took, you know, 5 or 10 seconds to start up. And so, of course, you know, it's easy to see that it was about worn out. So,
and
yeah.
If you got up there and cleaned it every year, it would probably still be running.
Exactly. Exactly.
But that's a pain. They get up there and clean a ceiling fan.
Right. And so it depends on the maintenance, you know, whether you're in the environment, things like that. But for the most part, yes, you can. And certainly motor technology is very ancient now. Electric motors have been around for, hundreds of years?
120
or something
least,
like that. So, you know, it's not, I'm not worried about it. But what we're kind of getting to is, you know, if you're talking about smartphones or even any handheld phone, the remote devices, what, you know, what was he using to over-design it? Was he, because, you know, was it derating like you believe in of everything?
Well, they probably derated it. They probably did a version of halt and fix stuff. They were probably worried about dropping, you know, because
tumble
and
test
making
where
it
you
pretty
put it
robust.
In, you put it in a big tumbler and you see what
see
breaks,
what happens,
you know,
and then you fix it.
And that's the point I want to make is that it's not, you know, are you getting anything out of your testing? You can always get something out of your testing if you look at it from a different frame of reference. And that is from the strength of what intrinsic strength of the electronic materials and system have and the operating range or margins, empirical margins, observable that under stress that you can you can compare between samples, between previous designs. And that is, you're getting something out of, you're going to get something out of all testing. And I go back to the quote from David Packard. It is absolutely true today as it was when he said it in 1972. Reliability cannot be achieved by adhering to detailed specifications. Reliability cannot be achieved by formula or analysis. Some of these may help to some extent, but there is only one road to reliability. Build it, test it, and fix the things that go wrong. Repeat the process until desired reliability is achieved. It is a feedback process, and there is no other way. And that's what I want to say.
No, it was built
the big thing.
It was built into HP.
Right.
It was build, test, fix. That was the motto.
Right. But the testing is what I'm I'll focus on. They're not testing to what they can. If a product is still, if you haven't tested it to where it won't operate, you don't have to destroy it. But if you don't test it under stress to where you have an operational limit, okay, you're not getting all the information out of it. It may break. Yes, you may just, you may get a catastrophic failure. And that teaches you a lot. But if you're not using all the strength in the product to find the weaknesses, you're really losing a lot of money. You're really leaving a lot of money on the table.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my point.
Oh, I totally agree. And I have story after story after story where that proves true, but it.
Yeah. All the prediction stuff, he says,
think of it may help
to some extent, but
No. Think of the international standards that are, created by a committee to the lowest common denominator. And often they all wanted it to be, well, we need to be able to pass this test. It was the old pass-fail test. Did it work through this stress? And then it's so watered down, like drop testing, for example. You mentioned tumble testing for handheld phones, and I've seen those. It's basically a cement mixer with baffles in it that you're banging the daylights out of this.
You got to wear hearing protection.
And then you open it up, turn the phone on, and it works. These guys were making robust phones. But the idea is the standards, there's no passing that test. You don't have functional products. They would have to say, all right, we're going to put it in the cement mixer, turn it by hand gently, make sure there's rubber foam all around it so it bounces nicely, and do that for 2 seconds. And then you can say it passed XYZ standard, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And they're so watered down. Not all of them, very many of them are. And then lots of other reasons not to like standards, but somebody said, we need to put something on the data sheet that says our product works. And, and using the argument of the build, test, fix things is, well, we ran out of things to fix. I bet you there's still more if we had more time, but we just ran out of big things. It's not a good sales point. Except for you and me.
We ran out of things to fix. And we feel this product is as strong as the fundamental limit of technology can allow it to be. Okay. We know that this is also comparable to our last phone. Or
you're not going to see that in a Super Bowl ad, Kirk.
I know. We're talking about the internal discussions. Okay. To management and to whoever, it's an OEM, you're making a phone for somebody and whatever. And they may dictate the test requirements, but if you're developing this for somebody and you want to, shorten the time, you'll before you do their required design validation or your validation testing, which is usually showing it meets its spec and you can test it, 0C and 35C or whatever. And so, the point is, if those that learn to make it as strong as it can be in general, early in the product phase and test it to limits to find those weaknesses, is going to save them a lot of money in the, long run.
Yeah.
And it's just curiosity. How strong is this? I mean, what is our problem?
Could fail. It's just it's curiosity. But that's what I think what the Packard was all after was you can't improve something if you don't know how it fails.
Right.
It's kind of the gist of it.
Right. Like for instance, waterproof. I mean water resistance. Yeah. Okay. That's not a standard halt test. And we generally don't think about it. But now with the smartphones, most of them being water resistant, I certainly hope that Apple and Samsung and all of them test that till water intrudes into the case, pressurizes. They go to 30 feet, and of course you can just use a pressure chamber, but going within a tub of water and going up into several atmosphere pressure, equivalent to several deaths, that they go to that limit. And then they look at several samples and see with dye penetrant or something like that, that they've, where the seals
where the incursions are. Yeah.
Where the incursions are.
No, and the issue is that, and I ran into this, is a company was making a wrist exercise band type thing, right? And they had a port on it so you could plug it in to charge it and to download data and stuff like that.
Right.
And they sold 70,000 and 50,000 failed in the first 2 weeks. And I said, what did they fail for? He says, well, corrosion. And they said, we don't understand. We tested it according to the standards that are used for watches, the Swiss standard for water resistance. And he said, let's take a look at that standard. And it was put it in 3 feet of water, like 1 meter of water, take it back out immediately, shake it off. And if it's still working, you pass the test. Yeah. I said, even if water gets into it and you shook it off, it's still going to work. It takes about a week for the corrosion to actually short out your system. And he says, how did you know that? He said, because that's how corrosion on electronics and moisture happens. And
it's a chemical reaction.
They hired me on the spot and had me help them figure it all out. But they'd never recovered. They were able to stay in business another year or so, but then that mistake shut them down. Shut down their company.
I know they've come a long way in the water resistance. I had an iPhone that just because I think my daughter threw a water balloon at me and it was upside down in my pocket with the power connector. It was before US Lightning, I actually think.
It was the old USB-A,
And I took it to the Apple store.
And he saw this little blue dot.
Red dot.
Red dot.
And he says, that's not our problem.
Water on it.
I mean, that was to me a way of just saying now you can, I think it's 30 feet, and I'm not going to test it in the Bahamas, but you know,
don't drop your phone.
And especially salt water. I mean, talk about the worst kind of water you can put on electronics. You know, that's the thing. Technology improves, it gets stronger many times, gets better, more robust. By the fact that, you know, we most of the smartphone manufacturers have addressed the main problems, which is breaking the glass, and the Gorilla Glass is incredibly strong. Now. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, here's a dilemma here for you, Kirk. Right? The way many of our markets work, and there's an arc to it, even cars, right? Or cars where you needed a new one. And there's, I want a new car in my driveway for status. It's not that I need a new car.
Right.
I want the new phone because it's stylish versus that having the last year's phone. And I want this and I want that. Now, when the first phones came out and people started adding must-have features and really good improvements to speed and capability and all the other stuff, people were changing phones every year, except you. You never did. and now it's, you know, it's every 3-4 years people are still, you know, except for the ones that do it for style or whatever. But let's say you know that your phone, for the bulk of your revenue, for the bulk of your market, is widget A, is only going to last in somebody's hands before it becomes technologically obsolete for two or 3 years.
Right.
So how do you draw the line of this pursuit of build, test, fix to get to technological limits and say, why are we over designing this? In those cases, it only needs to last 2 years. Now you get the advantage that you get almost no warranty failures over those 2 years, unless it's the water thing or whatever.
Right.
But it's the argument on the other side is just make it good enough. Don't make it great. And I find that argument hard to rationalize with people when we know that 80% of our market's going to buy next year's model anyway.
Right. And that's so much technology is true with CD players, DVD players. We have such a technological evolution now. It's just mostly streaming. So even though CDs and vinyl records are coming back,
Getting TV screens with resolutions that the human eye cannot tell anymore.
That's
talking about that earlier. Yeah.
And, you know, just like the sound back in the 70s, my electrical engineering professor would argue that you can't hear the difference in a total harmonic distortion between 0.1 and 0.01 and 0.2. So why are you guys arguing all this? It's just one-upmanship, you know, and that kind of thing. But my thing I talk about, we've never really gone on to what I consider mostly the elephant dance, is everybody estimating and working on predictions for the end of life of components and whatever. And they used to use the Arrhenius equation, also known as the Arrhenius equation, because it was misapplied to so many things. In fact, you'd still have to model for any activation energy. You'd still have to do hundreds of samples to get some kind of spectrum.
You'd have to do the work to figure out what it is.
You'd have to do the work. And by that time, you know, so it doesn't And also, the cost of building a robust product is not that significantly higher. And you don't necessarily need to use, you know, highly rated components or whatever. Somebody asked me if they should use military grade. And I said, no, because the military grade requires a whole bunch of extensive testing and actually may use a significant portion of the life. You never know. So, you know, just use standard components. They're pretty strong if they're built correctly. And that's another problem. And they're not counterfeit. Well, if they're counterfeit, they're not probably built correctly, but or taken from a reject pile or something like that, which
you're talking
happens
about
all
issues
the time.
That are at the start of life through manufacturing error, supply chain
throughout
errors,
the manufacturing, right.
You know, tons of those things happen.
All the manufacturing chains, all the supplier chains that are to make one, you know, chip from wire lead frames to the epoxy capsulant to everything.
Silicon,
everything.
Gold wires. There's
all of those, one of those streams could lose its process control or, you know, somebody grabs a quick, you know, thing from the back.
Oh, they put engineers on the floor when the staff has their annual get together. That's, you never want to buy anything the engineers don't.
So anyway, the end of the bathtub curve is for many products is irrelevant. It's not ever going to be seen. And we're really never going to know if he takes that phone and puts it back in his drawer and then comes out another 30 years if he, you know,
probably still worked.
It'll probably still work. Right. They've got plenty of life. And my pinball machine, as I've talked about before, has 1983 chips in it. And they're the original chips. And they were on location probably running 24 hours, you know, or
18
being
hours
beat up
a day.
All the time. Yeah, it's very well routed machine. So I'm not worried about those chips failing. I don't think they're ever going to fail. And
it's more than actuators, the coils.
Exactly. All the mechanics. We talk about that. Definitely limited because they use material. They're consumable materials in the sleeves and the solenoid piston and plungers and things like that. And also, you know, they shake. They got a lot of vibration. That's why solder joints sometimes fail in them. And but they don't get a lot of thermal cycling other than their own self-heating. Yeah. So, you know, it's just, if you look at the perspective, for the most part, the most expensive problems for a company are in the beginning, at the front end of that bathtub curve, where you've introduced a product and it starts failing in the field. Yep. Okay. And you know, it's always a learning curve with any manufacturing product line.
You know, and it doesn't have to be. I've worked with some teams that, you know, we paid attention to where are the risks in our supply chain and assembly processes.
Right.
And let's get those under control. And it pretty much... just that attitude of pay attention to where it came from and how it's built and make sure it's stable. It's consistently stable, and especially when we're doing volume stuff. And even workmanship standards, you know, how do we make sure that somebody is not doing this 8 hours a day and is just blind to what they're doing, and it leads to mistakes? The human factor is part of assembly counts too. But we started doing that, and one of my clients then said, I got called back for their next project to help them get that going. And I said, so whatever happened with that first project we were working on? And they all got real quiet. And I'm like, well, I don't think I'd be here if it was a disaster. He says, no, we actually had to call our customers to find out if they even turned it on yet or not, because we hadn't had any reports of any failures for the first 2 months. Yeah. And this is when I was talking to him. And he says, that had never happened in our launches before. It was all hands on deck for 2 months.
Yeah. Well, engineers do design robust products without ever going through stress testing. And I've seen a new product also have very good margins, significant, and doesn't mean anything. But that means I've got lots of strength to use to find those manufacturing defects when we start the pilot and early runs. And that's what I need to do. And if I don't find them, you know, and of course, manufacturing can change at any time.
No, anybody
can lose control.
The design is solid. Design's solid. It'll be anybody can build it. Just throw it in the bag and shake it up. It's good.
Yeah, you've got to trust your suppliers and all that, and have them have some monitoring of their own things. But You know, a lot of our standards are, I know the IPC standard for solder on a FET amounted FET on a board on with its heat sink. Mm-hmm. I used some of the boards that I thermally cycled for thousands of times while they were operating had did not meet that specification for voids. Okay. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of voids, but even with those voids, it didn't cause failures in the 2,500 or more thermal cycles from minus 10 to plus 65 that I'd put these computers through. They didn't fail. So we don't even know if those standards, and we're never going to know because, again, I don't know if any solid state electronics is still in use from the 1970s or 80s. It still uses, other than my pinball machine and others.
Oh, you got to come out here. We have the Computer History Museum. They got, you know, they have stuff. Old
Yeah, and I'm sure the first Apple computers are still would be able. Yeah, they're still boot up. And I've had.
And the computer would look at you and go, internet? Well, and what?
I put those some of those boards after I ended the experiment of thermal overstressing, and you can go find my paper on my website. I'll put a link to it, but on thermal overstressing of standard PCs, and I put those away in storage. I put them in a card case or in a wire cage to hold them just for reference, and you know, later if I wanted mm-hmm. to look at them. And then I took them out and I said, well, I wonder if these things will boot up, you know, after they've been through thousands of cycles, you know, minus 10 C to 20 to 165 C. One of these things will still boot up, and they've been in storage. You know, I was sitting here, and I booted them up, and the clock was still running, and it was only off by a few hours. And I had set that as a side, and this was over a 3 or 4 year period. Well, I'm expecting, yeah,
after that total many failure. Years, clock's off.
Yeah, exactly. The clock's I'll give it up. The clock's off after that year. That little battery was running, and I never replaced any of those batteries. Right. The little nickel battery, you know, and so I think they even withstood that for years.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, yeah, this stuff lasts. So next time you buy something, buy the, you know, what you want to live with. And if you're not if you're fashion challenged like me, you won't need a new phone for a decade.
And do not buy an extended warranty.
Oh yeah, no, don't bother.
What a waste of time!
Companies make a lot of money at selling those things.
It's so. Not a waste of money for them.
No, you got to think of the other side. You know,
whether they'll be in existence, you know, 7 years from now. Yeah. So
I got to do a shout out to Stefan. Thanks so much for the story, and hope the shindig, your 25-year anniversary for the project you worked on, went well, and you have fun with that. But it's. You know, I knew I had to talk to you, Kirk, because you would, you know, tie right into this. You go, yeah, electronics are solid. Don't worry about it too much.
Yeah.
Have a good time. if designed well and the build test fix part comes right into it and so on. So, but if you're listening to this, if you got an interesting story of something you pulled out of the shelf and it came right back to life or unexpectedly long lifetime, we really need to find somebody at JPL that dealt with it. Was the Curiosity rover was like 15 yeah, years and expected yeah. 6 months or something.
Or how about the Voyager that's still out there, you know, billions of miles from Earth.
Yeah, talking
still
away.
Still talking to us and an incredibly low, what, it takes about 7 hours for us to reach it in the communication link or something like that. It just... phenomenal.
It's you know, things can work and we can be pleasantly surprised sometimes by it. And other times we're dumbfounded. Why is this not working right out of the box? There's a pretty good range of things that go on out there. But if you've got a cool story like that or have a question in general about reliability in related fields, let us know. We're always interested in what you got going on and what's on your mind. You can do that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. And Kirk and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So lots of ways for you to get to become involved with the chat that we do on these shows. So with that, Kirk, I don't think I have any old electronics laying around. I went through a big purge of e-waste a couple of years ago. I bet you I can find something.
you know, getting the adapter plugs and, you know, the right interface, that's to power them up. I've got some old phones. I don't even know if I can do that, but they, you know, there's nothing for them to do. I have old PCs that still work, but they're technologically obsolete. I can't really do anything with them. You know, they just,
well, put them on the counter for a weather station, you know?
Yeah, something like that. I know. So, all right, let's talk again.
All right, will do, Kirk. Talk to you soon. Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.